Saturday, 1st May, 1976.
It might be useful this afternoon to consider together Krishnaji's presentation of discipline, the meaning of the word, its purpose, and so on. As you know, time and again through the years, people have gone to him and said that they have practiced this discipline and that discipline, and they found perhaps this result and that result, but not what they really sought. And then the discussion proceeds to hinge around the point that discipline, as ordinarily understood and practiced, is forcibly conforming, that is, compelling oneself to conform to a set of precepts or techniques in order to gain a result which thought, the discursive mind, can picture and can formulate. The people who inquire are people who say that they are searching for God. They want to discover the meaning of life. They want to know what truth is. Or they want to realize silence and inner peace and so forth. This is what the people say. And then Krishnaji generally asks them, do you think that your disciplines, your sacrifices, your conformity with a set mode of life is specie with which to bargain for that which is beyond all bargaining? Can you buy the immeasurable, the eternal? He uses these terms. Occasionally he uses the word God also. Can you buy these with your virtue, your cultivated virtue? That is, a virtue which you enforce upon yourself, involving inner conflict in order to triumph against its ambivalent, complementary vice. And of course people begin to see that obviously this cannot be done. And then Krishnaji also puts out the meaning of discipline in this, more or less along these lines. The word discipline, derived from discipulus, a learner. If one is a learner, one is a disciple. But there is a vast difference. In fact, there is an immeasurable gulf fixed between the meaning of learner in Krishnaji's sense and the meaning of the word learner in the world's sense. In the worldly sense, learning is a process of acquiring knowledge, a skill. Acquiring the ability to deal with life in the world in accordance with preconceived ambitions, ideals, and whatnot. They call that learning. But all this comes within the realm of thought, and thought deals only with that which is past, which is not alive, which hasn't come into being. And he proceeds to point out that if the utterly new, if you like to use the word, the transcendent, a real creative inspiration, a creative flash does come into one, it has no relationship with the past. And then that flash gives rise to further thought, and this is where the trouble comes. Because that further thought is utilizing old forms in order to bear the new life. And it won't. You spoil the new life, he suggests. How then does one live as a learner in Krishnaji's sense? And this is where I do feel Krishnaji has made one a truly stupendous contribution to humanity in understanding, in trying to understand the meaning of learning in the profoundly human, the wholly human, which is the truly religious sense. If one is to be a learner, so that the immeasurable, God, the truth, reality, completeness, perfection, were to flood your being and remain with you as such, then the mind must be completely open, which means one must be absolutely watchful with regard to the uprising of all our accumulated beliefs, convictions, and so on. Now, note carefully, time and again he also says, of course you have to have knowledge in the old-fashioned sense where all the ordinary know-how of physical living is concerned. You can't drive a car unless you learn it in the usual way and conform to that knowledge and conform to the rules of the road and so forth. But that has nothing to do with the fulfillment and the fruition of you and I as human beings. Our humanness has to come in to be fully liberated. I use the term subhuman. I don't think Krishnaji has ever used that. You see, we are in a subhuman stage. We have not really blossomed out into our full humanness. So, in order to blossom out into full humanness, our task is not attempt positively to seek full humanness, but to let it emerge by being well aware, completely aware, of the obstructions within ourselves. This is what we can be aware of. I don't think Krishnaji has ever put any explanation, correct me if I'm wrong, as regards why this apparently negative method is the really positive method. We have time and again talked about this kind of thing in our group meetings. The point is this. The fruition, the coming to fruition of a human being into his full humanness is a process of growth. It is not a process of acquisition. It is a living process. And we have considered the fact that here is our own living body. Have I any control or power over this mysterious process by which the body grows and lives and functions? I can spoil it. Wrong food, wrong drink, overwork, anxiety, I can spoil it in a thousand different ways. But it itself remains a hidden mystery. This mysterious power, this mysterious energy. Now this is even more so where what we commonly call the mind is concerned. For the mind to come into fruition, we have to let this transcendent reality, that is to say the human mind, we have to let this transcendent reality function freely through our mental processes. Our mental processes, our mental states, psychological conditions, our neuroses, psychoses, our sane conditions and our mad conditions, in whatever proportion they may exist in our life, they are all the expressions of what happens as the result of this transcendent energy, power, God, call it what you like, affects the living organism. Then it throws out a form to express the effect, to express the effect. And those forms are our thought forms, our emotions, and so on and so on and so on. So you see, this is something which mankind hasn't at all woken up to. Not yet. Nowhere near woken up to. If we look at the scriptures of the past, we do find this sort of teaching of Krishnamurti implicit in their teachings. For instance, it comes out pretty strongly in aspects of Mahayana and in Zen Buddhism. It comes out quite strongly to let this essence of mind, as they call it, just function freely. They leave out certain points. They tend to leave out certain points or soft pedal them, but they do mention. Huineng, for instance, does definitely mention the necessity for purity, for the mind which is utterly clean. Then it functions. It's put in theistic religions with the saying that it is not the acquisition of virtue or this, that or the other which enables you to enter the kingdom of God, but it is the grace of God. But what they don't sufficiently point out is that the grace of God is hindered, is thrown out of the window by me myself, because I am unclean. I exert an influence which repels the grace and the transcendent, the omnipotent, never exercises power, compulsive power. This is something we don't know. We have to experience it to realize this. If we are totally open to it, then suddenly we awake to the true meaning of omnipotence. This all power, this extraordinary thing. And in that we realize what it means to be a human being and what immense power we wield without knowing how to wield it. And here it is a virtue not to know how to wield it, because it uses us. We don't use it. We use ordinary energies over which we have control. And it is simply one of the main reasons why we have become so appallingly conceited is because of the fact that we have learned how to harness the energies of nature. And we have developed this conceit that we are lords of creation, we can bend everything to our will, forgetting all the time that there is no such thing as my will in the absence of you and the universe. If you and the universe disappeared, I disappear, and I can exercise no power whatsoever. And that holds good for each and every single being. We just vanish out of existence. We don't know that. But once we really sort of see into it, we say, just be quiet. And then this wonderful reality starts functioning through the living being. And then all one has to do is to see that this living being, let me use the word machine for once, this machine, all it needs is to be kept clean, neat, well oiled, and it will go on and on forever, so to say. Not hindering the manifestation of the full fruition of humanness, which means divinity, in fact, through each and every one of us. Now you see, this is learning. This is the art of learning. By doing nothing which is the product of personal will, of personally preconceived, premeditated goals, activities, purposes, and so on. Because all such premeditation and all such preconception is invariably and inevitably self-centered. So now you see, so when these people come to Krishnaji and they ask these questions, Krishnaji suggests that the real discipline is to be free of conformity with what is premeditated, preconceived, what is presented to you as a system, a technique to get to heaven, so to say. You can see that if one looks at it with a clear intellect, even without needing some sort of profound inner insight, look at it with a clear intellect alone. On the one hand, we will accept the omnipresence of reality. After all, we are living, existing in the total reality. We are in it. And now we say, show me how to get to reality. But I am in it. What a stupid question. How to get to it? I've only got to just be mindful and aware that this is the nature of the reality and not define it. Concepts will inevitably arise. Thoughts, ideas, all sorts of things will inevitably come into being, you see. But they are all the expressions of the fact that I am in reality and interacting with it all the time. And these expressions of the living being are all excrescences. That which is thrown out. And You can compare it with the phenomenon of hunger and food and so on with considerable exactitude. We are hungry, we eat, there is digestion, there is assimilation, and there is rejection of what is not wanted. One excretes that which is not wanted by the living organism. stimuli come, inspiration comes, that is the food. Your study, your thinking, our talking together, all our sense observations and so on, that is the food, if you like. It undergoes a process of sifting, of classifying, of this, that and the other. Certain things, the essence is assimilated, and the essence has to be assimilated not in this situation as so many fixed ideas, but as the growth of faculty, the faculty to perceive the truth of things immediately as they are, which is pure intelligence. And that's why I always, right from the beginning, I've always laughed at these intelligent quotients and intelligence quotients and intelligence tests and all the rest of it. I mean, it's too childish to bother about, really. You see? It is the development, the release of faculty within us. Right. So, the release of the faculty is that which we assimilate, corresponds to the assimilation process where food is concerned, and all the particular ideas, the particular thoughts as they arise, let them pass out. Don't grasp them, don't hold on to them. Concepts, they are bound to be, they have to be, in order that we may structure all our perceiving. Otherwise, we couldn't structure it. Otherwise, we couldn't know it. The concept is the card, mental card index, by which we know that's a bus, that's a man, you see, and so on and so on. And, it seems to me that it is somewhat along these lines that one may understand. There are sure to be other lines, better lines. Understand Krishnaji's attitude towards the whole question of discipline, therefore. This is learning, growing happily. A living process, an acquisitive process, is a mechanical thing, it's not an organic thing. And every acquisitive process comes to an end. There is no end to life. Birth, death, yes, they are finite things. But life is not finite. It is the immeasurable. It is the immortal. It was never born. It cannot die. It is. It's a totally new dimension of awareness. You see, what an extraordinary, I mean, it can completely revolutionize our whole life if you really understood even this one thing which Krishnaji presents. Our striving to have things nice for us, for ourselves, to be free of all our difficulties and our problems and so on, to be away from what we do not like, and to have what we would like to have. All that nonsense disappears. You see, the living organism is a psychophysical organism. We use the words very glibly, but the brain, the mind, isn't awake to the fact of psychophysicality with sufficient intensity. What in India they call nama rupa, name and shape. Instead of the word name, some have translated it as mind, but I think it would be preferable to understand nama as informing life principle. It is the life principle that animates what would otherwise be just an apparently inanimate structure. You see? Nama Rupa. Now, this Nama Rupa, from the time it is born, is conditioned in this, that and the other way, seeks this, seeks that. I like this, I want more of it. I don't like it, I want to avoid it. It's painful. That's no way to learn. That's no way to see the truth of a whole situation. See the whole truth of the whole situation. Supposing I'm in deep sorrow. This, that and the other has happened. Or in grave difficulties because this, that and the other has happened. What is my natural tendency? Is it not to excuse myself, to soft pedal all that I have done and continue doing to contribute to the trouble, and to be very critical and perhaps inflate that which I say is external to me? Oh, it's that man, it's that woman, it's this firm, it is that workman, it is the government, etc., etc., etc. Is not that tendency there? So to start with, I do not see the whole truth. I'm not able to see the whole truth. I have to be like Lord Justice Goddard on the bench. The marvelous. I have been present years ago. It was a wonderful experience. Twice I have been. Pre-war years. Or was it? No, during the war, I think. Listens. Just listens. Looks. Observes. Each witness, as he gives his evidence, different counsel presenting their cases, and the whole thing is seen clearly as possible. And then there is a balanced pronouncement about what appears to be the true nature of the whole situation. Now we never do that with ourselves in our own lives. What is the implication of doing that with ourselves? We must catch ourselves out with our beliefs and our preconceptions, our assumptions, our prejudices, our biases, our assumptions. Any and every one of our assumptions, especially the most clearly formulated assumptions, have no warrant in truth. When the grace of God suddenly bursts in upon you and completely blows away all the darkness which we call our mind and our knowledge, then suddenly you see that, yes, this is so. See? Then faith takes the place of blind belief. Open-eyed faith, which sees the reality of the void unblocked by any finite particular misshapen object in the way. Then we begin to live the truly human life. Don't ask me how. How do you relate this to are ordinary. They have no relationship. How do you relate yourself here to what you were as an embryo in the womb? You can't. You've finished with that world altogether. And yet it is from that world that you came into this world. We needn't go further back than the womb, at least I can't trace it any further back. You see, that world has no relationship to this world. And yet it is from out of that world that we emerged into this world. So, we here, as we are, what we are, seeing ourselves, if we truly learn, then we emerge into this new world of mind and consciousness. The pure mind, the clean mind, the pure intelligence, the faculty to see the truth of things as they are. You see? And the mind is void of all ill, then. And if the mind is void of all ill, then that person can take in his and her stride everything that comes to one in life from moment to moment. It may be painful, it may be deeply sorrowful, but one is able to swallow that poison, not be killed, but transmuted inside. You know, Hindu art and Buddhist art has portrayed this very wonderfully in all their grotesque, some of their very grotesque figures of the gods, you know. But good gracious me, the wisdom embodied in all that is something fantastic. How do we make the new world? Accepting by making it within ourselves. I'm saying make a new world, but we don't make it. We allow life itself, transcendence, totality, this mysterious power which is omnipotent, universal, omniscient. We just allow that to function freely through us. And then, whether the event from day to day, from hour to hour, is painful or pleasant to this organism, physically and emotionally also, the right thing only is happening. And you see, if one faces sorrow that way, it leaves no scar upon the mind. Consider how our minds and hearts get scarred by life. Just look back and see, what are the things that are outstanding memories? The failures, the sorrows, the hurts, the insults, the deprivations, the missed opportunities, as we call them, and so forth, the regrets and the remorses, and this terrible drive, this in the deeps of the unconscious, to grasp, to gain somehow or other the fulfillment of our stupid, projected mental images and conceptions. Take one of the world's greatest problems, especially in modern times, the man-wife relationship. Or if one has not known what marriage is, the hankering for the partner. But I'm hankering for the obtaining of a mental construct, not of the real life partner. In God's good time, the real life partner is there, time and again. But we are all so blind that we miss it. We make a picture. Then we say, I must get a life person to step into that blessed two-dimensional canvas. And no three-dimensional living person can possibly step into a dead two-dimensional canvas. Quite impossible. But don't we do that? This one wasn't good enough. Oh, I don't like him or her. Off I go. Chase somebody else. Ah, now we are going to be happy ever afterwards. Good God, inside 2 months?
Well, I never thought it was going to be quite this, you know. And so on and so on.
And so often repetition. Exactly the same as the one before. I've seen it so often.
And if and when there is a second and a third disappointment or some such, or a third hurt, the second one is 4 times as strong, the third one is 27 times as strong. 3 to the power 3. The second one is 2 to the power 2. It's like that. Are we learners? Good learners? We say we learn from experience. We indulge in charming terminological inexactitudes. But we're not truthful with ourselves. You see, Krishnaji is one of those who mercilessly holds up the mirror of truth to us. Of course, a good many just shut their eyes immediately. They don't want to see what's in the mirror of truth. They don't want to see themselves as they are. They play ostrich. All right, you may play ostrich. But the ostrich presents the whole of its body to any marksman who wants to shoot it. So there. Tell me, isn't there a curious happiness, a release, in seeing a fact like that? An inner release. Not the kind of release, not the kind of seeing which says, oh, I won't do it again. No, that is a compulsiveness. If I really see, then I will naturally and inevitably not do it again. Spontaneously, I will not do it again. It's a spontaneous condition. That is to say, it will not happen again through me. I'm past it.
I think on a few occasions I've caught this. It seems to go with a recognition that I don't know.
Excellent.
This is very rare. One usually knows.
Where does it? Where there is real vision, there is the full awareness, not conviction merely, but the full awareness that I do not know.
It's rather like I've always felt it, or rather recently felt it more strongly, removing a filter in ourselves. The filter being the known, that which comes to us from God, if you like, I use this word because I can't think of any other, comes up against this filter and is translated into what we know, what we want and what we don't want, and so on and so forth. But there comes a time in one's life when, through love, really, through love and suffering, this filter has to be attempted to be removed, and God help you then, because the whole lot seems to flood up and nothing can be wrong. Nothing at all can be wrong. God cannot be here and not there. So wherever you go, whatever comes to you is quite right. Not according to the filter.
each one of us has to respond to the actual situation which is present without saying, I don't like this situation or I like this situation. As long as there is the limited personal, I like, I want, I dislike, I don't want, as long as that is there, we are subhuman.
When one thinks about this, such as now, it's quite obvious, isn't it, that the whole of what we call reality, the real world, is very largely our own distortion.
Our own mental construct.
Our own mental construct, which is a distortion.
Exactly.
And this is what we call reality.
Yeah. You will find certain things towards the end of my book in connection with complete attentiveness, related to complete attentiveness, which will probably interest you quite a lot.
First,
yes?
I think you mentioned in the book in one or two parts that practicing discipline is arduous. Could you say a little bit about that, please?
Look, real discipline, and we are talking now of discipline not in the sense of conformity to a laid down system, but in Krishnaji's sense, the real discipline, to be intensely awake, wide awake, in the Buddha's word, mindful, to be intensely mindful of what is, with one's own beliefs, convictions, all out of the situation, or one's own standards, evaluations, judgments, and so forth. You see? Now, to practice this from moment to moment every day is supremely arduous. There's nothing more arduous than that. It takes every bit of resource and energy within you to let that state supervene, to let that a kind of mindfulness, of attentiveness function. You see, this is one of the deep meanings of fervor, phrase which the Rig Veda and the Atharva Veda, a word which the Vedas used, of Tummo, the psychic heat that the Tibetans talk of. This is one of those things. This is the ardor of the spiritual aspirant who actually is a saint. See? This ardor, this tremendous fire, this fiery passion, which is utterly unself-centered. It has no center anywhere. It has no objective. It has no goal. It is a state of ardor, burning away. How often I said the sun, as an example. You see? This, to let this be one's constant condition, in the right sense, in the true sense, is very, very arduous. See, look at it another way. This arduousness, this kind of discipline, is the removal of that which obstructs transcendence. Instead of seeking a positive good, which would have to be preconceived and preformulated by the mind, which is a hopeless business. You see, when this happens, the response from transcendence, or the fact that this transcendent power works in you now unobstructed, is like a million atomic explosions taking place simultaneously. I remember Krishnaji using this phrase in the past. I am rather glad he doesn't use it anymore. He said, then there will be an explosion in the mind. That was not a very happy word to use, explosion. Just as his use of the word revolution, especially in the past years, was not quite a happy word to use. A complete transformation of the mind is what he really meant with the word revolution takes place in the mind. You see? And similarly, it's not explosion, but it is this tremendous lighting up. And this lighting up, if you yourself aren't pure and really clean, able to take the 100 million volt charge, impact, you see, it will send you potty. It will kill you even. So you have to be pure. You have to be the right instrument. Now, there it comes, the whole question of virtue vice. You can't... this is where some of these crazy people, you know, beatniks and God knows whatniks, all that type, they all go crazy and they think, oh, now we are gods, we are enlightened, we are this, that and the other, lords of creation. Absolute stuff and nonsense. It's hard work, you have to be pure, and they can do what they like, they say. They can't. Look at the extraordinary misinterpretations that have taken place, even at the hands of distinguished scholars. I'll give you one example, R.E. Hume, the translator of the 13 Principal Upanishads. He was the head of the Union's, the theological department of the Union Theological Seminary in New York, which is one of the which is one of the greatest institutions of its sort. His introductory essay, which he has there in the Upanishads, when he talks of the ethical teaching of the Upanishads, that the Upanishads say that you are beyond good and evil, then and the Upanishads use language which now, like the words revolution and explosion, I think are unfortunate, use language which is a little bit unfortunate. In that condition, that is to say the condition of transcendence, perfection, there a murderer is not a murderer, an adulterer is not an adulterer, and so forth. People get the idea, oh, you can just do exactly what you please and play merry hell and you'll be the Lord walking on the earth. No, absolutely nothing of the sort. No nonsense. In those days, you got hanged before you committed the murder sometimes. Which was in some ways a good thing, if you believe that prevention is better than cure. No. Absolute purity of life. And there is no equivocation possible as regards the meaning of purity of life. I mean, all these wretched philosophers and intellectuals, they are pretty brainless in certain ways, who go on arguing, oh, it all depends on what you mean by purity. And so on. If you don't know what purity means, look it up in the dictionary. And if you don't understand what the dictionary says there, then go to a brain specialist. And that's that. Have no truck with all that nonsense. No condoning of what is ill. Compassion, yes. Complete compassion and understanding. But complete compassion and understanding is impossible if you are prepared to condone, if you are prepared to be self-pitying or falsely excusing and so forth. This is where
some religious, atheistic religious theologians are perfectly correct when they point out the devil as the devil. He is the devil. And why hurt his feelings by trying to make out that he's not such a devil as he is? He'd be very offended. He has his function. And he said, good gracious me, this fellow being my defending counsel, I don't need one. I am the devil. His satanic majesty. You know, Milton understood that very well. Really, Paradise Lost, especially the first three books. But there again, you see, if we really understand that all that is within ourselves, then we will look in the mirror of truth and look at the devil unflinchingly, not antagonistically, not hating, not saying, I will change you, old boy, and make you into a good chap. Oh, no, 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 no. When I look steadily, completely, with absolutely open eyes, that dark shape, the devil, changes into a figure of light with golden wings. It is me, myself. And the stronger and more powerful the devilishness, the greater is the corresponding power of goodness into which it is transformed. It's the transformation. Transmutation. Not just painting the poor chap white. It is, I always feel, if only this kind of passion for reality were allowed to function freely through us, sensibly, unreactively, unmilitantly, unevangelistically, all these are mistakes, but in the right way, the complete clear seeing which enables you naturally and spontaneously to cease to do wrong in thought and feeling, in word and in deed. Then an extraordinary thing happens. You are a tremendous power in the world. And you never know yourself how that will affect mankind through the ages. Only consider the great founders of the religions, for instance. How those half dozen or a dozen people, whoever they were, changed the history of man and have influenced man through thousands of years.
One of the troubles seems to me is that most of the time to this we say yes, but with reservations. I want to hang on to just that bit. Let the rest go. I want to hang on. That's rather nice. Let the other go. We almost always have reservations.
Well, hang on. One can only tell the person who wants to hang on, hang on. One day, that peg will come off the wall. And then, be careful of how you feel here and here. And the longer you have hanged, the further downwards will safe ground have receded. Better come off it quick than later. Because the consequential effects accumulate not in arithmetical but in geometrical ratios. They multiply.
I think it was Maurice Nicol, and I think other people have used this term, which always struck me, jumping for the rope. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good expression, jumping for the rope.
Jumping for the rope?
For the rope, yes.
Jumping for the rope.
To have the courage to jump for the rope.
Yes.
And nothing else.
Ah, right.
It's an interesting expression, this. In the jumping must be the giving up.
Exactly. Yes. Everything else you must let go of everything else. To realize full humanity. Not our pictures of humanity, oh, happy, handsome, healthy, successful, all that rubbish. Out with each and every single concept and adjective. Step into the void fearlessly. Step into the void fearlessly. If you want to use an analogy, if you could step off into the void, you won't fall. The gravitational forces will merely keep whizzing you round and round. It's quite safe. If you can stand that temperature and so forth. You see, we are afraid, aren't we? We are afraid of annihilation. It's not death we are afraid of. It is annihilation, the association of our idea of annihilation with death.
Yes, I think one can see this. It's the fear of giving up deep-rooted beliefs and ideas. Mind, generally speaking, these exist in other people. They don't exist in me. One can fear. They always exist in other people. One can see it, but never in oneself. I think it is this fear of giving up. And all the time we've spent on them since the year dot.
See, of course we use the argument, but I know from a lifetime's experience. What do I know from a lifetime's experience? I make the assertion, I know from a lifetime's experience. But do I know, with or without a lifetime's experience, how much more wonderful and marvelous it is to be without this conviction, this view, this idea? When the mind and the heart are free, who's going to fight for freedom? Who's going to strive for freedom? Either in the nice way, by sitting around a table and coming to a mutual agreement, or by the horrible way of cowardly, ruthless murder. Who's going to do that sort of thing? The whole thing would stop by itself. When do I feel murderous in myself?
I'm getting pretty near something I want to put under the cart and not face.
if this little world is transmuted into a pure world, a healthy, mature world, fruitful world. I know him saying in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. Who has understood? But if this is converted into a truly fruitful world, who knows what seed will spread and what will rise up in consequence? Who knows? The strong, healthy, mature tree doesn't know anything at all. And it is because it doesn't know that its seed scatters and you get wonderful things happen.
Seems to me there's a logical fallacy in all this, though.
Yes.
If you say you jump for the rope whereby you abandon everything, you therefore have the rope as the ideal, you have the totality as the ideal, as it were. And therefore, you substitute for everything you've abandoned the rope for totality. And therefore, you'll become too attached to that particular concept. This is how I feel about it.
Yes.
And therefore, one is still caught up in concepts. And what has always troubled me is how one relates concepts to understanding. Concepts, I suppose in Krishnamurti's terms, or words or whatever you like, are thoughts which are essentially of the past, part of our conditioning or whatever. So when we listen to you, you talk to us and use words, when we read Krishnamurti, when we read anybody else, we're still in terms of the past, memory, thought, as it were. How, therefore, does one make the jump from that conceptual world of the past to understanding? Or is understanding itself merely a concept, as it were, and therefore there's no jump necessary?
Would you like to... look, when Derek used that phrase, jump for the rope, you see, it's a figure of speech. When I use the phrase, step into the void, it's a figure of speech. In order that man may communicate with man in his ordinary physical waking state, we are inevitably constricted in our means of communication. We have to use concepts, ideas, words, language, with their specialized meanings according to the dictionary. They can stretch a little bit up to a point, you see, and so forth. We have to use that. But if we bear in mind that all the time we are using this in order to get free of it, the thing can happen. You see why? A word, a thought, a concept has power quite beyond the printed word, the spoken sound. Quite beyond it. supposing I write a letter to you and I say, with love and best wishes at the end, ever yours, you see, and so forth. Now, the words as they stand, more or less, have a nominal significance. It's a form of writing, it's an expression of good feeling, and we take it as such, you see. Supposing you and I are truly in love with each other, you see, if I say, I love you, the significance, the power of that is immensely greater than as a mere nominal statement, I love you. Isn't it? When two lovers, when two people between whom love has grown up, declare their love, affirm it in its final concrete form as the spoken word, plus whatever else may attend the spoken word, you see, then it is this, it is the supreme expression of it. But when that supreme expression is present, what else happens besides the limited formal expression? An extraordinary state of being, isn't it? You see how kind, how generous nature is. It has given the living organism actual physical possibilities and opportunities for this sort of experiencing by which one transcends in mind and consciousness all the limitations of the physical. This morning, you noticed what a marvelous sunny morning it was. And did you notice the extraordinary peace and harmony and joy in the atmosphere? A joy which was beyond physical, beyond sensation. Just a sensation of joy. It was something profound and deep. Now this is the change that takes place in the actual awareness of the living being. Here, for instance, just at present in the garden, the trees are in full bloom and lovely, you see. And the morning was just like being in heaven. Now, the actual experiencing, the actual feeling and the thought associated with it, and it's all so quiet and harmonious, and it's a real harmony. Not just a noise of pleasure. You see? That takes place. So now, concepts and words have this extraordinary power to stimulate. And when the stimulus goes right into our heart, as we say, and the word heart in this context means the innermost mind, the essence of mind, one's innermost consciousness, then there takes place this turning about in the deep seat of consciousness, the deepest seat of consciousness. And it is this kind of experiencing which enabled men and women through the ages to affirm transcendence, to use the word God, to use the word the unknown, that which is beyond all expressing and limiting and so forth. When Krishnaji talks about the immeasurable, and the benediction of the immeasurable will be upon you, see. Do you think he's just using poetic phrases? Of course, a person can, if he's gifted that way from birth, as a writer, as a poet, he can use such phrases and produce them. Dante was a marvelous example. He wasn't truly a great mystic. His personal life was horrible in this, various aspects. He was a rascal. And a bit of a swindler and all that sort of thing. So you needn't class him amongst one of the holy ones in the real sense. But the good God gave him that gift, and he was able to produce Paradiso, which is one of the supreme productions of realized transcendence in poetry.
Rose, I wonder, a thing that occurred to me too about talking with the person. The words such as the void or jumping for the rope have an entirely surely different significance if they are used in the present as against a going back to the past, in which case it becomes a completely different thing, a hackneyed phrase, whatever. It's not the actual words, but it's the use of the words in time, isn't it? It's something like this.
This raises up the whole question of time and eternity, and logical concepts and understanding. Understanding is this unformulated, unlimited faculty of the living organism. You, the living being, understand. Just like that, you don't know what understanding is. You can't produce it on a silver salver and present it to somebody. What you can put on your silver salver and present to others is what arises the next second or the next hour after that actual experiencing of the living understanding. Thoughts, words. Then it is formulated. It is brought, it is precipitated out of the invisible, intangible, unknown, unknowable eternity, the unseen, the totality, the absolute, you see. It is precipitated out of that into the limited, the finite, the particular thought, concept, etc. This process is going on all the time. Now this precipitation, insofar as our consciousness reacts to it and is limited to it, is therefore makes us aware of everything in terms of time. But understanding or love in its transcendence or whatever it is functions only in eternity. It is shapeless, formless, it never began, it will never die. It can't, you see. It is not an entity. That's the mystery of our being. The non-entity, the infinite, the transcendent, is restricted, embodied in this. And you see, our task is to wake up to that fact. We can't wake up to that fact by merely accepting the idea and trying to make a happy, a pleasing, logical concept, or shall we say, a really brilliant concept, which will be a guiding principle for my daily life. No, not that way. What is the guiding principle for the living process of this living body? I don't know, and nobody can tell me. It is this mystery which is life, which is the guiding principle. But the secondary stages which follow from the fact of the guiding principle of life, life principle operating through this body, the secondary stages, eating, drinking, working, sleeping, etc., etc., you see, all that is the finite and the particular. You see, and naturally you've got that kind of mind which is necessary for your work too. You've got that kind of mind which is really very good to look at it and look at it with doubt, look at it critically. Krishnaji himself has said, I remember very well when he said it in Amman in the late 1920s, the campfire talks. Doubt everything. Doubt is a healing ointment. But the right kind of doubt. Not the doubt of these annoying, miserable intellectuals who said, oh no, I don't agree with that at all. And if 5 minutes later you said the contrary, he said, oh no, I don't agree with that. He has forgotten that he hasn't agreed with what you said 5 minutes before. That's worthless, that sort of doubt. But this doubting means having the mind completely open. You say, ah, yes, I see, yes. And then, having said, I see, yes, wait a bit. Be awake to it. And you will find that the seeing, or what you thought you saw, undergoes a change. It is transforming all the time. And be prepared to swim with the transformation. You see? Now, this is the meaning of the doubt. Not to hold on to an idea and fix it. Well, I mean, modern psychology even knows that the fixations in the mind are blocks. Frightful blocks in the mind. They lead to illness of the mind and don't allow the mind to come to maturity.
our growth and evolution as human beings. Necessity lays it as a necessity upon us to do everything in our power to allow the mind to grow to maturity. Consider how your sensible mother and father allow the infant to grow into a strong, healthy fellow, instead of making 101 different mistakes and making him grow up a little bit of a weakling or something physically. Now, nature does that for us willy-nilly, more or less. By the time we are 25, 30, this body as a body has come to its maturity. But the mind? That is our personal responsibility. This is where nature hands over to us and says, now, my lad, get on with it. This is one of the great meanings of the riddle of the Sphinx. Man wakes up to the sense of selfhood. Sense of selfhood not in the wholly restricted egoistic sense, but he suddenly becomes aware, my God, I'm a man. And in a dim way he senses that here is something transcendent as compared with the dog's awareness of himself as a dog. You see? And then the riddle is just this. The Sphinx says, without uttering a word, it says, well, my man, now what are you going to do with the incarnation within you? This is the great riddle of the Sphinx. This is the real riddle. What are you going to do? You have a just thrilled to the fact that you are God incarnate. What are you going to do? How are you going to live?
I think we've all got this extraordinary habit, at least I have a... Even generally speaking, when something actually is seen, we hang on to it and we treasure it. We haven't got the trust or whatever it is to let it go.
That is to say, you see, to put it in a more precise form, forgive me,
please,
to put it in a more precise form, we prevent the growth of the mind by clinging to the condition the mind has arrived at this moment. But the mind wants to grow, and it squirms under our forcible inhibitions. The body will grow to a certain size, an optimum size. Nature has seen to that. But there is no limit to the growth of the mind. The body grows in time and space. The body is a measurable thing, but mind and consciousness belong to eternity and the immeasurable. The sky is the limit, and the sky will never be reached, is the thing that is never reached physically. The sky is the limit. See, in mind and consciousness, we grew that way. And if we are really sensitive to these things, then so much evil to which we cling hard to our own evil, that just falls off.
It's interesting because, in a way, hanging on to something that, where there has been a penetration, where it has actually been seen in time, the hanging on of this makes this a terrible prison wall, because we escape to it. We escape to the past instead of letting it go and being in the present. And the psyche does this sort of thing.
See, this is where the deep meaning of complete attentiveness comes in. And how many times in our group meetings we have touched upon this? Total attentiveness to the immediate now.
means that you are free of the limitations of past and future. We think about the future, that means we form pictures about it, mental constructs. On the basis of a dead past. When I say dead past, the past is dead and it is with us in terms of all the lumber, the miserable lumber of our fixed concepts, our mental constructs. This itself at this moment is not the product of a dead past. It is the immediate present which is the resultant of the continuous transformation of the whole of the past. What this was on the 1st of October 1902, when it came out, now, it came out of his mother's body. From that moment onwards, it underwent transformation, and what this is now is the result of that living transformative process. It is this which we are so dull-witted that we just don't see the tremendous significance of all this. But we hold on to, our brains are capable of storing pictures of the past. You see the patterns of the past, and we keep them all in our, what is it, our files, you see, we file them all. And oh yes, yes, now, oh yes, when that happened, yes, now let me look back into that. And I try to, but where is my intelligence now then? Why don't I use my faculty of intelligence and understanding? My faculty to do this, that and the other physically, right now. I don't want to refer back to how I managed to get over the front gate and get onto the pavement when I was a little fellow like that climbing. I don't need to. I just went over the gate now. I would dream of performing all those antics again, but we do that with our psychical life.
One might add, invariably the wrong connections are made on top of this.
Yeah, exactly.
It occurs to me to say, listening to what you've just been saying, that why don't we see it just like that? Now, in asking that, of course, I'm expecting you to tell me, instead of me, I mean, I'll go at myself, you see. I have no real reason to ask you to tell me, except that I'm jolly lazy or too painful, it's probably too painful to have a go myself, which is what we do all the time, isn't it? We are hoping that somebody's going to tell us. And even then we've got to come to terms with it, because we've got to ferret it out for ourselves, because in your last analysis I can no longer believe you than Krishnamurti or anybody else. It's got to be me finding out for myself.
Exactly. And the finding out is a continuous process of growth, remember. This is the important point. Finding out is not finding out another set of ideas or another concept to replace this concept. You know, time and again the criticism is leveled. Yes, 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 this is so terrible, really. You've just cut the ground completely from under my feet. I have nothing now to rely upon, nothing to stand upon, they say. You see? What have you to put in its place? Good God, do you... You don't like your old handcuffs because they're getting a bit rusty and... verdigrisy or whatever it is, you want new handcuffs, nice shining new ones. What is it that you want? Be free of the blessed things, you're completely, right away. The mind can't sort of see that.
I mean, Gretel and I have noticed this, with, not to go into boring detail, but friends of ours we've known 15, 20 years, connected with other groups, shall we say. But they're nice people, and they come along and they say, but this system, as far as we're concerned, doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere. But Krishnamurti hasn't got a system to offer. What can you do? Take a deep breath. Start all over again. It's terrible. He hasn't got a system. Isn't it terrible? Can you explain the system? Wait, explain.
Look. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? You take an engine, really good engine, working perfectly. It is reliably systematic in its performance. There is system there. That is one manifestation of the meaning of the word system. Take this living body. Supposing it functions quite healthily, perfectly, day after day. Doesn't it function systematically? But there are two different kinds of manifestation of system. The one is mechanical, purely repetitive. There's no question of growth inside the engine. It doesn't grow. This, it doesn't undergo a metabolism, the engine. But this undergoes a constant metabolism, a constant change, and yet is perfectly systematic, organically systematic, as contrasted with mechanically systematic. Now, you put that to your friends. You see? And look.
They're supposed to know this.
That mechanically systematic engine has to be worked by you, a living being, who function and successfully function organically systematically. Now, where the mind is concerned, is the mind a machine or an organism?
Yes, they've been learning this very thing of the energy which comes from going against mechanicalness, psychological mechanicalness, and they come up with such a question. It's one can only laugh because one can see this in oneself.
Well, that is how it is. I mean, after all, man is a slow learner, and he undergoes so much pain